that's a lot of big projects that will have impacts within the neighborhoods. We, for example, this month have a developer coming in who's putting in 8 units, but they're in the midst of single-family housing. No parking, that's going to affect those neighbors, and they want to have an opportunity to speak to the developer, see what accommodations can be made to make the project better and more compatible with the neighborhood. I would recommend, if not a 10,000 square foot threshold, a number of units threshold, and the current code, which has 5 as the threshold, seems suitable. That would put it above the missing middle housing that will come in with the residential infill project, but capture projects that will have large impacts on neighborhoods. The inclusion of the sign, we're fully in support of. We think that's a great way to create outreach. One of the big concerns we have, though, is that the current system is a one-size-fits-all system, and it doesn't work for every neighborhood. This new system is a one-size-fits-all system that isn't going to work for every neighborhood. The current system works very well for Overlook, for Arbor Lodge, for some neighborhoods that have active neighborhood associations. We invite every developer who contacts us to come present and talk to our neighbors. And by and large, they are all very happy to do it. And I expect under the new system, most of them would be happy to come to the neighborhood association. Some, however, are not so happy and don't really want to engage with the neighbors. And I can foresee opportunities in the code here for developers who don't want to engage with the neighborhood at that level to avoid an effective meeting. And one element of this in particular that will enable that is the requirement that the meeting be within 2 miles of the neighborhood. That means that a project going up in Overlook could have a meeting in St. John's, and it could be held at an awkward time, Sunday afternoon. I appreciate Commissioner Fritz trying to narrow down that some, but what our neighbors have right now is one-stop shopping. Every project is going to be at the Neighborhood Association meeting. They know that. They come to our meetings, and they're able to hear from multiple developers at one meeting. With this approach, they might have to go to 4 or 5 meetings in a month to find out what's happening in the neighborhood. And so my suggestion is that neighborhoods be given the first right of refusal on these meetings, rather than just say, developer, you have to have the burden. You have to go to the neighborhood association. If they're willing to host it, you need to do it there. Otherwise, do it somewhere else. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Hi, Mayor Wheeler, council members. My name's Leah Fisher. I'm the Neighborhood Planning Program Manager at Southeast Uplift, which is one of the 7 coalition district offices. I work with 20 neighborhood land use volunteers who process these notices. Therefore, this change directly impacts my program and all of those neighborhood volunteers that I work with. And we have been tracking this project closely. So I'm going to be speaking on behalf of myself as a staff person, but also on behalf of the Southeast Uplift Land Use Committee, which is an advisory board to an advisory body to the Southeast Uplift Board. In my role over the last 2.5 years, I've witnessed personally all the challenges that were highlighted in this report, and I support the proposed changes. I feel like it's going to really address the major limitations of our current code in all of the points that are touched on earlier. I would like to add that our Southeast Uplift Land Use and Transportation Committee also overall supports all of the proposed changes in this report. The committee really appreciates that early opportunity to connect with developers. I think a lot of them do have very productive meetings and are able to affect change. I think having the expanding the zones and making it consistent is something that they appreciate. I would say from my observation, the biggest piece of the proposed changes that the group has grappled with are those triggers and those thresholds. I think looking in Southeast specifically, there will most likely be fewer required meetings with developers, and the committee or the Land Use Committee understands this, but they feel like citywide, if there's going to be more meetings and interactions with developers, it's going to be overall positive change. I am sure that they would be supportive of a variety of tweaks that have been mentioned here. The Land Use Committee would also ask City Council to require in this code that developers also contact neighboring organizations if the proposed project is on a boundary line, as Linda mentioned, or within a certain proximity of other geographic boundary lines, knowing that the impacts of large development don't end at neighborhood boundary lines. And then additionally, our committee would also encourage that the code be accompanied with supporting materials, as have also been discussed, best practices, guidelines for developers that are engaging with neighbors, and as recommended by city staff. And then lastly, the committee and my program would just, we greatly appreciate the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability's thought and effort that went into this, particularly Sarah Wright, who has come to multiple meetings and been very accessible and able to explain the changes to all of our neighbors in a really understandable, great way. So thank you.
Thank you. Could we get Sarah and Eric to come back?
We've got one more.
Oh, I apologize.
I need to switch places.
Best for last. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Well, thank you. I hope so. My name is Heather Flint Shadow, and I'm an urban planner. I'm a former government planner, actually. I used to work in long-range planning and redevelopment. I used to run a mixed-use zoning program. And I'm a sustainability expert and green building consultant. And for the last 6 years, I've been co-leading with Lynn and Etta Coven and a large coalition of neighborhoods and business associations, the Division Design Initiative. And so we have many initiatives that we've been developing during this time, including an initiative on neighborhood notification and community engagement. And through that process, we've also developed Main Street Design Guidelines, our top 10 policy recommendations for the City of Portland. We've done extensive policy advocacy, data gathering, surveys, public engagement, and really tried to work with the community on raising design literacy to help people understand that design is much more than aesthetics and style. It has to do with the form, the function, the quality, the durability, the longevity, and the livability of many of our projects. So one of our top recommendations, in fact, the top recommendation, was notification. Because we had now 16 projects in our neighborhood very, very quickly without any opportunity to have meaningful and timely input in the process. So we have changed the face of our neighborhood without ever really engaging the people in that place about what their vision was for how they wanted development to look. The Division Green Street Main Street Plan was important, but it did not talk about the architecture beyond a very limited amount of design standards. So we would like to just share a little bit about our notification policy, which has been now adopted by multiple organizations, including the Richmond Neighborhood Association in 2016 and now in 2018 by South Tabor Neighborhood Association and Hosford Abernathy Neighborhood District. But in our top 10 policy recommendations, those were endorsed by more than 10 different organizations and business associations. So the differences are the size thresholds. RNA policy is stronger. The submittal requirements, are we asking for the right information to understand really the impacts of a building and how they may fit with the context or not? And then do we have the right follow-up requirements? We have developers come to a meeting and never write a single word of notes. And so they may say they've submitted a letter to you to document what happened, but there's no real check and a way to follow up with that. So our policy has all three of those things. We're grateful that Sarah has done a wonderful job. I also just want to compliment her. She's been incredible, and I hope that you will get her back immediately. But she has incorporated much of our recommendations into the appendix as encouraged items. So we would like to, one, quickly support these large signs prior to permit submittal. I would encourage you to actually advocate for a 45 to 60 day time frame. Our policy has these timelines because we have people coming a week before they go in for development permits. It is far too late in the design process for any real change to happen, and that could be a missed opportunity for real synergy and better livability and better quality because neighborhoods understand the identity and the context. It's fine to shift the responsibility to the developer as long as it goes through the neighborhood association first. We would also like to encourage that you take a look at these 25,000 square foot thresholds. And I see my time running out. I have some great graphics for you, so I'd like to just ask if I could have a little bit more time to help you walk through this.
Because you have provided great artwork, we'll make an exception in
Thank
this
you
particular
so much.
Case.
I appreciate
Thank
it. You. And we've really tried to be proactive with tools for you.
Thank you.
So the square foot metric is really not the right way to evaluate this because it results in very different impacts. It's not consistently addressing the degree of impact, and you're going to hear that from us on DOZA as well, because we
DOZA,
the design overlay zoning amendments, which are our new design standards and guidelines citywide, which we will be coming back to advocate with you on that for our design guidelines, which I passed around. So it's not really relevant to the context, the scale, or the form, or the impact. And so my husband, who is also an architect, put together these little graphics to show the difference between if you are on a 50-foot wide lot or a 75-foot lot or a 100-foot lot, you end up with a different de facto threshold for triggers of a community meeting. It's too high for a narrow main street. It's too low for a wide street. So you may end up triggering a 75-foot building at that threshold, which is missing all of our main street buildings. None of them, in this context, are going to be addressed. It's a big, big concern. It may be too low for a wide main street or civic corridor. So we're proposing, and we've written some language for you, that you either go with the 10,000 square foot threshold or four stories. So here's our proposed language, taking the exact language that you already have and changing that to if a building is less than four stories, that it would fit neighborhood contact one, and neighborhood contact two if a building is four stories or greater. That Sarah pointed out some really good elements to me, that we needed to have better parity across the city. We care very deeply about the Main Street impacts because those are some of our greatest assets as a city. However, we realize that it needs to be simple and we need to be able to be responsive to impacts in all of our different contexts. So that four stories, as much as we might like three stories on our main streets, we wanted to give you something simple. Maybe that could be revisited later. This is the context challenge that we face. This is a graphic that was produced by Bill Tripp as part of the Mixed Use Zoning Committee in a presentation of unpacking the division problem, which never made it to the community. But we were there and we saw some of these great illustrations that documented what some of the impacts are to these areas. We're really not very responsive to the context, and this is actually even a probably smaller development envelope than what we really have. So how that affects some of our greatest assets, I think I heard Chloe say once that our buildings are our brand, and I love that. And really, you know, we're hearing from Travel Portland that they're sending people out to the neighborhoods, that, you know, it's really a draw for people. These are some of our greatest assets that are part of our identity of how we see ourselves, some of our foundational architecture, that on the east side where we are actually underserved for art, these subtle details of these buildings become our art. And so when you have a very large building, it dramatically impacts the feel, the character, and the overall quality of the district as a whole. So why it matters, it's the context that really impacts this. So poor compatibility, it's not about the density. It's
so
about the design.
Can I ask you a question about
yes.
this? I don't dispute anything you
yes.
just said. But getting back to the context of
yes.
this particular, this is really about a notification requirement.
Absolutely.
And you're getting into something of a zoning and FAR conversation.
Well,
so
I'd be happy to clarify.
Please
yes,
do. Yeah, bring it back and help nail the point home.
So the point
me,
is,
I think you're onto a
yeah.
A
the
good
point
thought
is
here.
Is that if we don't relate to, well, one thing is you have those neighborhood meetings. They're very important for helping that developer be a better fit, that development be a better fit in the neighborhood. And so this is what we're asking for as part of submittal requirements to really be able to understand context. And that's what's in our notification policy, that we don't ask people for a context elevation where you can see at a glance whether it's in context or not. And so that's something that we could be requiring as part of the process to help both neighborhoods and city staff understand how well there's a fit. That building right there would not have triggered a neighborhood notification for a development meeting. And so things like this, this context elevation, can help that big building relate to some of its smaller pieces. And this is from some of our older documents, building blocks for outer southeast neighborhoods. And so this building fits better with its context, and you can see that in a glance. So we're asking for that context elevation to be part of the city's request. So this is just a good example right here of a successful meeting with the business association where this building came in, and we happened to be presenting our new design guidelines, and they heard the city or the business association really concerned about the impacts of the building. Then they heard our presentation on the design guidelines. They went back and changed the building design and made it fit better with the context. It's contemporary, it's high density, but it fits better. And so those, you know, these very important resources, these meetings can lead to less conflicts, a better affordable design, and I'll tell you why, a smoother and faster process for developers, and a better fit with old and new. So we're very concerned, and we want to make sure that the buildings reflect the vision of the people who live there, but there's also a lot of psychology of place that's important. And as we are building our new vision for our city, are we relating to context? Right here, we have nothing that relates to context. They may be interesting and exciting, but we're also building really expensive buildings right now. These are not more affordable buildings. I might like the contemporary buildings, but they're not more affordable when we're actually cantilevering out. We're not using good design traditional practices that are actually more affordable. Many of these are using more traditional time-tested design practices to add density. And if we don't do it well, we're turning people off of density. So one of the other last pieces I just want to mention as we think about how we grow and trading and evaluating these public goods. We want affordable housing, but we also need quality and livability and sustainability. We are not tracking and measuring these impacts. So one of the things that we're working on is a sustainability scorecard. We encourage you to come to our event at Design Week for Design for Affordability, Resilience, Sustainability. And we think that if you were to kind of weigh some of these public goods and think about some of the pieces that we've got in our policy, that it might actually help us get better, more sustainable, more affordable, context-sensitive design.
Very good.
Thank you.
You get the plug right here at the end. Very nice. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Could we have Sarah and Eric come back just for a I'm sure some people might have questions. First of all, I always like to give first of all, Sarah, congratulations. I always love it when I hear people say, even if they have an honest disagreement, I love it when I hear people talk about City of Portland employees as being thorough, thoughtful, and fair-minded. And we heard that from a couple of people today, and I want to acknowledge that and thank you for that. You're making us all look good. And Eric, you do all the time, so thank you. Is there any reaction you have to any of the testimony, the question about the 10,000, the question about a first right of refusal at the Neighborhood Association, some of the concerns that maybe were just raised in this last PowerPoint presentation about certain types of buildings maybe being out of scale but not necessarily triggering a notification requirement? Do you have any extending the timeline from 35 to 45 to 60? I'm just wondering if you have any quick thoughts for us on any of this.
The first right of refusal definitely came up with the Planning and Sustainability Commission. It was something they were interested in, but it would require additional time in that 35-day time period because there would have to be a communication time period in there. So it was a concern about extending the time that it would take. That was what came up there. And in terms of the threshold being square footage as opposed to, say, stories or FAR, square footage is something that's very measurable and easy to address when the permit comes in. So it is a much easier threshold there.
Could I ask a question about that? Because a couple of people mentioned four stories.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it seems like four stories is also pretty easy to measure. Is there some advantage in your mind to the square footage over, say, a story requirement?
A story requirement actually would be a little bit weirdly hard to measure because do you measure it from the ground level, from the basement? So what is the ground floor? There's some wiggle room there. But it's also a question of if four stories is the threshold, then what about a really large one-story building on a large lot? Does that not... I think there's just questions about whether four stories.
There's a trade-off there is what you're getting at.
There
is
are on some of our larger streets, too, that you're going to see most development being over four stories. So you'll have a street like Sandy or MLK where the expectation is five or six often. And so do we want to be triggering kind of automatically every project on some of those larger streets? It's a question, too.
Commissioner Fish.
I was struck by something Linda Nedokovin said about at the new seasons, I think four different neighborhood associations converging on a corner. So where you have the convergence of neighborhood associations, and therefore it's a little artificial to say that it's primarily the concern of one neighborhood association or another, could we tweak this to provide a condition under which you might give more than one neighborhood association written notice if it was close enough to the boundary?
Yes. Yeah, it could be written into the code that it would be, you know, to the neighborhood association, business association within X distance of the site.
I'd be interested in knowing whether that's workable, but it seems reasonable where you might have more than one neighborhood association that does have an interest and feels impacted by the design, particularly where they converge. So some geographic boundary, I think, is worth considering.
Commissioner Fritz, and then, oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Udaly, please go ahead.
Oh, gosh, since we're not voting today, I just wanted to say thanks to everyone who came and testified. You all brought valuable input to the conversation, and I think Sarah also did a great job, but maybe we have a few more things to consider. I mean, my primary concerns are, you know, when we talk about public outreach, what's the definition of public? And I think for too long it's been property owners or just the neighborhood association. And so when I had BDS, I directed the Bureau to, when we were required, when mailed notices were required, to go out to all residents, not just property owners, because everyone has a stake in their communities. And I've never seen a definition of public that defines it as property owners. So I'm glad to see we're expanding that. And then I guess I just want to reiterate a concern, although whoever was it, RNA, brought the sample document that was really helpful for everyone who didn't see it. There was just a kind of little spreadsheet or matrix of community concerns and how the developer addressed them. And I think in almost all instances, there was some kind of change or consideration made. That's heartening to me. It makes me feel that these meetings could actually be more productive. I want the public to have a greater understanding of the whole process and when is the time for them to actually, if they are not satisfied and cannot accept the development, like what are the steps after that? But I'm not going to offer any specific amendments. It sounds like we have some thinking to do before we do the final vote. So
Commissioner Fritz?
So I'm concerned about the changes to historic review and design review and land use reviews, that this applies there too. And so we had lots of testimony from community members that having early input can make things go more smoothly, that there's more of an opportunity to change, affect the development before it gets too far down the line when it becomes a battle. So particularly for historic resource review, doing away with the current standards and making it only at 25,000, that could be a huge impact on a historic district.
So all of the requirements about the historic review would remain. So all the notification requirements where property owners would need to be notified, those would all remain. The land use review, the quasi-judicial notification requirements would still be in place.
But not the neighborhood meeting. I'm looking at page 67.
Right. So the neighborhood contact, if it's less than 10,000 square feet, there would not be a neighborhood contact requirement.
I think that's really problematic. I hadn't realized that until I started looking at the Division Main Street issue, and my earlier question is, if you're in a planned district, usually in the zoning code, the more restrictive applies. And so what we're doing in this project is getting rid of requirements for neighborhood contact, which I think have really benefited developers and made projects go smoother. And particularly when you get to the Historic Landmarks Committee and Commission and the Design Commission, you know, they have very challenging reviews anyway with multiple meetings. So if in addition to that, this is the first time that the neighborhood or any community member has been able to come in and say this is completely out of context. That's a big problem.
So we are, yes, I mean, I think contact is valuable and early contact is really valuable. What we wanted to do with this proposal was to separate it out from the type of land use review or the type of city process and say all projects, regardless of where they are in the city, deserve the same treatment. So we that's where we separated that out.
This really flies in the face of 25 years of planning, mm-hmm. and that we have said that in a land use review where there is, by state law, a requirement that community members can weigh in and can affect the outcome, that there should be earlier contact so that there isn't that adversarial relationship. I'm okay with this for building permits because those are done by right anyway, as Commissioner Udaly was saying earlier. But for land use reviews and historic reviews and design review, I think this is a huge change, which I'm not. Maybe others, because you gave me a briefing a month or more ago and have been to multiple community meetings, maybe others are only just finding out that this applies there too. So I'm a bit, I'm very concerned.
So I would suggest we continue this. We've heard excellent testimony. This would ordinarily go to a second reading, but we deliberately are keeping the amendments open because we want to have time to consider that. So we'd continue this hearing anyway. I'm very appreciative of the work that you have both done, Sarah and Eric. I think the more I hear about this, the more I realize this is an incredibly complex riddle that you're trying to solve here. It is the proverbial balloon, right? Squish one side, it pops out somewhere else. And so this is really about thoughtful balancing. And is there a particular urgency to this? Is there some reason why we can't continue this out a ways? And then we can have some conversations and see how we can take into account some of the context that's been provided through testimony, some of the issues that have been raised by Chris and the Planning and Sustainability Commission, respect the work that you have done and others in the Bureau have done, and see if we can get closer to a consensus on this. Would that be okay? So we probably need to pick a date, at least a placeholder date, but I'd prefer it not be too soon. I'd prefer it to be at least a month out unless somebody tells me that's not going to work.
I don't think Carla had time for at least a month out anyway, right?
That would be my suspicion, given that we're in the budget process.
Yeah.
Right, and we have a lot of absences. So the first day I have everybody in, including Commissioner Hardesty, is April 11th. Would that work at 2 p.m.? It's a Thursday.
A Thursday afternoon?
Yes, 2 p.m.
I was going to say
an afternoon, but I think an hour and a half.
I would prefer an afternoon meeting because it gives us more time to have these kinds of conversations without the pressure. So I would subscribe to that.
Could we make sure that it's early on the agenda or the only thing on the agenda, just so we can make sure we benefit from Commissioner Fritz's presence
on this? 2 p.m., I'll make sure
that's great. And so we'll...
I've got to go. I'm on city business going to Ashland to speak at a conference for the League of Cities. So...
Ashland, huh? I could go. and that, is that all day, or is it just at that particular time?
And it's the following day, so I need to catch a plane to get there.
So are you able to be here till 3:30, or you have to take the flight at 3:30?
I did not, unfortunately. I'm not that far ahead in my... I have booked the flight, but I don't have it in my phone.
Could we see... What's the week after?
Yeah,
that?
Thank you. Then you're gone.
Commissioner Fritz is gone both days, and then you're
again,
gone...
Again, on city business.
And then you're gone the following week, the last week in April. So if we're looking at May...
Well, since it won't be such a long thing, maybe we could do it. Let's have a try for the 11th,
okay,
and I can
and
be there for
the
an hour, mm-hmm. and then.
That's good. Yeah. If we can do a lot of staff work prior to then,
yeah,
then maybe
and
we
I'd
don't
certainly
need
be
a,
happy to meet with you ahead of time.
Just a process clarification to make sure we have it right. Are you extending the hearing, including public comments, through then, or are you closing the hearing deliberation?
We are closing public comment unless there are new amendments or significant refinements, in which case we'd be obligated to open it up to public testimony on whatever the changes are.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So the record is closed today, but the hearing will continue until April.
April 11th at 2 p.m.
At 2 p.m. However, if additional amendments are proposed on that date, public testimony will be reopened at that point.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it would still be a first reading, though.
Yes,
so
correct.
So the vote would not occur on that day.
That is correct.
And hopefully, if we do have amendments, we can get them into the Tuesday memo or even into the agenda ahead of time so people would know about them.
Good. So I want to reiterate something I said earlier. I think this is excellent staff work by Sarah and Eric. And again, we're asking you to do the nearly impossible here. And I think we need to acknowledge that. But I think we can you've provided us an outstanding template to build from, and I think we can continue to refine this and get to a place where there is a strong consensus here. That could not have happened without you, and I appreciate it. So this hearing is continued, as was described earlier, and we are also adjourned. Thank you, everyone.